Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today with their analysis, political scientists Donna Hoffman, the Chuck and Barbara Grassley Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, welcome back to you.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Jonathan Hasid with us as well, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, hello to you.
Great to be back, Ben.
And we'd like to invite our listeners, as we love to have on Politics Day, to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, no big surprise here, but officially yesterday, Biden and Trump clinched their party's nominations. We'll get Donna and Jonathan's thoughts on how each may plan to win in November. Also, that prosecutor who criticized Biden's memory grilled in Congress yesterday. We'll talk about that. The split among Democrats over aid for Israel. And U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa seeking to move up in the Republican leadership with Mitch McConnell announcing that he is stepping down. We'll talk a little bit about the leadership structure, hopefully, in the Senate. A few other things coming up. We'll see how much we have time for. But first, some news that we had this morning from Congress, the U.S. House passing a bill with broad bipartisan support that would force TikTok's Chinese owner to either sell this popular video app or be banned in this country. All four members of Iowa's House delegation, Hinson, Miller Meeks, Zahn, and Feenster, voted in favor of the bill, a move that could affect it. It still has to go through the Senate, make it to the president's desk, and there are hurdles there, I understand. But with themes here, national security, free speech, social media, Republican leaders fast-tracking this bill through the House, limited debate, while the vote here lopsided, 352 to 65, and this despite TikTok's efforts to mobilize its some 170 million U.S. users against it. Also interesting, former President Trump changing, reversing course on this and being against it. Finally, at the end, President Biden for it. Wow. Donna, so much to pick apart here. Tell us what you see going on with this bill passing the House and how it fits into the larger context of, well, the narrow leadership that Republicans, the Republicans have of the U.S. House.
Well, on this particular bill, we see a bipartisan majority, really strong majority, as you noted there, you know, voting for this. It's showing in an election year that you're tough on China. As you also mentioned, the fate of this bill in the Senate is somewhat in limbo, I think. And I don't think the bill will look like it does now should it get past the Senate. Biden has signaled if Congress is able to get it to his desk, it will he would sign it. But one of the things you mentioned in your intro there was, you know, that TikTok mobilized its users, right, to illustrate to Congress, you know, their dissatisfaction with this, which actually might have backfired because it also served to illustrate the vast amount of power that TikTok had. Because as I understand it, I'm not a TikTok user, I will disclose, but on the app, as you opened it in the last couple of days, there was a message there and you had a button to push that a link that would take you to call Congress. And so we do know that members of the House in particular were inundated with phone calls. Mm-hmm. Ashley Hinson's office noted that she herself was answering some of these calls because here you have a bunch of people using an app they like. They're not maybe necessarily particularly political, yet they're being prompted, you know, based on a sentence or two to signal dissatisfaction, but they don't understand what is really a pretty complex bill. But what they are showing is that how TikTok was able to mobilize its users. In fact, to point out the power that TikTok has, and at the end of the day, that's kind of what the House was trying to get at, that TikTok has a vast amount of power. It's Chinese-owned, and there are national security concerns. And certainly in the last two elections, we've seen loads of misinformation about elections on social media, and this kind of plays into that power that these social media entities have. And so the national security concerns are something that Congress has been repeatedly aware of. And as you noted, President Trump, when he was president, sought to ban TikTok through an executive order. That was enjoined by a court. And then later Biden overturned that or wrote another executive order to override that. But Trump wants to do popular things. And so I think that's mostly behind his reversal on that that we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
Jonathan Hasid, you are our China expert here, so I'm very eager to hear what you have to say about this mega Chinese-owned social media company and this legislation.
Yeah, so TikTok, of course, there's a Chinese version as well that has a lot more restrictions. So actually, TikTok is substantially freer than the Chinese equivalent, offered by the parent company, ByteDance. It's a private company, but, you know, the distinction between public and private companies in China is often murky. Undoubtedly, the CCP is using TikTok to collect data on Americans. I mean, I'm sure they are. There's a lot of evidence for that. That said, it seems to me that this legislation has some issues. You know, there's obviously a first Amendment issue. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing. I mean, we have lots of foreign owned sort of media companies in the United States. I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch, very famously, until he became an American citizen, was Australian and owned obviously a huge chunk of the American media market. And so, in that sense, it seems to me that I don't know what the courts are going to make of this, right? The idea that we can ban a company just because of where it's headquartered strikes me as potentially problematic.
Yeah.
I think TikTok is potentially a national security concern, but it's also one of the primary sources of social media for people under 30. And, you know, as such, I don't know. I mean, I would be surprised if they could figure out something that was constitutional that didn't also have other unanticipated effects on other foreign-based media operations.
Well, constitutional, but what about enforceable, Jonathan? Should it get to the ban stage? We're a long ways from that. How do you ban this social media that's around the world and used by 170 million users in the U.S.?
I mean, I suppose you ban it the same way you ban online gambling in some stage, which is to say, like, very badly, right? And that is essentially accessible to anybody who has access to a VPN or a proxy server or something like that. And so I think that's right. I think it's probably unenforceable. The real aim of the legislation is to get the parent company ByteDance to sell to a non-Chinese company, to sell off all of TikTok. And you know, ByteDance may not want to do that. And if they do that, I mean, it doesn't have to be owned by another American company. I mean, it could be sold to another Chinese-influenced company in a way that complies with the rules. And so, I don't know. The whole thing seems to me a bit of a moral panic around a problem that is probably real, but is also a much larger problem than one Chinese app.
Mm-hmm. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's move on. So much on our plate to digest this hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you're a TikTok user, would like to weigh in on this or ask a question. Yesterday, President Biden, Donald Trump clinching their party's nominations. Biden crossed the line with a win in Georgia's Democratic primary. Trump won the Republican delegates he needed in Washington State. I'll throw in here that recent polling showing Trump leading Biden in many key battleground states. Donna, start us off with the challenges you see ahead for each campaign.
Well, so, you know, this was a battle for delegates in both of the parties. You need a majority to secure that. So that's what they hit, both of them yesterday. It's pretty normal that by mid-March, the parties usually know, generally speaking, who their nominee is going to be. But yet, it is still early. I would not put a lot of stock in polling at this point, because we know 8 months out is really not predictive of much. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the American public really doesn't start paying attention until the end of the summer, until the conventions come around, until Labor Day weekend. And, you know, for people who listen to this show who might be political junkies, that may seem rather odd, but we have research that backs that up. And so it is, however, now of primary importance that, you know, each of these candidates can focus on their opposition in the other party rather than internal things, which Biden really didn't have to do, but Trump did have to do some of that. And so at one level, we can say the general election season is starting. And certainly we have seen President Biden do some things related to kind of what has happened in some of the primaries. You know, so for example, in the State of the Union address last week, Biden put in that speech, because there's choices to be made as to what gets put in that speech and what doesn't. You know, he announced, made some news about putting in a port, right, to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza. Mm-hmm. And this has been something that he's been increasingly criticized for among progressives in the Democratic Party, lack of humanitarian assistance, unwavering support in some regard, right, of Israel. And so Biden's, I think, listening to those things, responsive to those things, and each part, each candidate, I should say here, has work to do to unite their party around them. Biden has less, I think, of a job to do here. Trump's coalition is pretty fractured. His base is with him and is going to be with him no matter what. But it's, you know, the, I think it was 77,000 voters yesterday in Georgia who voted for Nikki Haley. Now, some of those were early votes that voted for her before she dropped out. But that signals some real dissatisfaction with Donald Trump. And the real question then going into the general election for him will be, what do those, you know, Haley voters or non-Trump voters in the Republican Party do in November? Do they stay home? Do they vote for Biden? Do they vote for a third party? And each of those is a distinct choice and has different repercussions as to what they do. And so, you know, this is the time in which a candidate who has their nomination de facto will start to try to unite the party. That'll really culminate at the end of the summer with the convention. Adding into that mix, though, of course, is that Trump has a trial starting in New York on March 25th. He's got various other legal things that make our head swim just keeping track of them. And that will be something to you know, that he has to navigate during this process as well.
Yep. And we'll be back after a short break. Jonathan, we'd like your views on the campaign to come between Trump and Biden, a rematch of 2020. How is this different than 2020? There's a question. Also, this independent candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said to announce his running mate soon, perhaps the quarterback Aaron Rodgers. We'll get Jonathan's view and move on to some other politics in our news. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. Ben Kiefer back with Donna Hoffman and Jonathan Haseed in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
We're back with more of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our two political scientists, as we mow through as many political news items as possible this hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Before the break, talking about how Biden and Trump clinching their party's nominations yesterday. Recent polling showing Trump leading Biden in many key battleground states. Jonathan, weigh in on this. We heard from Donna. What do you have to say?
Well, you know, it's been obvious, I think, for quite a while that this is how it was going to wind up, that it was going to be a Trump-Biden rematch, even though, of course, a majority of Americans say that they're disappointed by this possibility in polling. But I don't think it's, you know, I mean, the 2020 race was weird, right? We had COVID, we had, you know, all kinds of disruptions to our daily lives and the voting system. And so, you know, that at least is going to be quite a bit different in 2024. But, of course, the same old candidates, you know, I think the race will not look all that much like it did in 2020. In 2020, you know, Joe Biden was a bit more of a mystery about what he would do as president. Of course, his rhetoric was very centrist. And I think that appealed to a lot of people in the Democratic Party and people who didn't like Donald Trump. Since then, he's governed arguably, I think he, you know, sort of tried to govern as a centrist, but then moved left as it became clear that that wasn't really viable. And so in that sense, Biden is less of a kind of a cipher, kind of a generic Democrat, if you like, than he was 4 years ago, because, of course, he's been president. Trump, by contrast, though, is, you know, views of him have really hardened, especially since January 6th. There's a huge chunk of people. I don't know how huge it is, but there's a substantial chunk of people inside the Republican Party who made clear that they will not vote for Trump under any circumstances. You know, these are people who, as we saw, like voted for Nikki Haley in Georgia, potentially even after she dropped out of the race. That said, right, ultimately, most Republican voters will come back to the Republican Party. Most Democratic voters will come back to the Democratic Party when the election comes. But I suspect that Donald Trump has a ceiling of support that it's going to be really, really difficult for him to breach. And so in that sense, like, the polls now don't look great for Biden, especially in swing states. But as Donna pointed out, it's still early. Most people aren't paying attention. And it's sort of shocking to a political scientist that, like, so few people pay attention to politics, but I guess that's how, you know, for us, it seems really important.
Yeah. And for listeners to this show, seems shocking, right, as Donna pointed out. It's like, what? You're not going to pay attention until a couple months before the election. Okay. What about, Jonathan, what about the independent candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? Too early to say where that will draw voters from Biden, more from Trump?
You know, the polling has been mixed on this. I think it is too early to say. I think if RFK Jr. picks someone like another anti-vaxxer like Aaron Rodgers as his VP nominee, then I fail to see how this wouldn't pull more, Trump voters than Democratic voters. Ultimately, this is going to be, third party, of course, cannibalizes from both sides, right? But it's from both Democrats and Republicans, but not necessarily equally. And it seems to me that Kennedy tried to run as a Democrat briefly, tried to get the Democratic nomination, got absolutely no momentum whatsoever. And that suggests to me that there just isn't a lot of appetite for him right now among mainstream Democrats. And his message may well and does seem to be tailored more to resonating with, perhaps MAGA Republicans or Republicans who don't like Donald Trump. So my guess is, although, again, data is short, my guess is that this will actually potentially help Biden more than hurt him.
Donna, before we move on, what do you think about RFK Jr.?
I try not to think too much about his candidacy because it's really not all that serious, but yet at one level, but then it is at another level because of the role that third party candidates can play in our system. And so, you know, the intent here is to have him run as a Democrat to spoil Biden in some ways, to draw upon that Kennedy name. One of the major donors to RFK's campaign is also a major donor to Trump's campaign. But yet, in terms of where I think he's going to end up, like with Jonathan, I think he'll end up probably taking more votes from a Trump candidacy than he does from a Biden candidacy. So that backfires somewhat in terms of maybe how it was intended to happen. But, you know, what voters have to understand about a general election campaign in the United States is that because we have a two-party system and also because we have an electoral college, that you have to vote strategically, and third-party candidates don't win in this system. Now, if you don't like that, and there's a lot of people who are dissatisfied with the two-party system, that's fine. There are things you can do to change that, but it is not actually to vote for a third-party candidate for president because of that spoiler effect and the implications or the consequences it has on who actually ends up being president. So we have to recognize that we have to vote with our heads, not with our hearts, in our system at the presidential level, meaning that we have to be strategic voters. And you have to vote for what is possible, not what you want that you think might be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to talk about the prosecutor who yesterday criticized, well, not only yesterday, but criticized President Biden's memory. He was grilled in Congress, interestingly, from both sides of the aisle. Robert Hur investigated Biden's handling of classified documents, testified yesterday about his decision not to charge the president. Before we get comment from you, Donna and Jonathan, let's listen to a little bit of the testimony. The former special counsel Robert Hur defending his inclusion of the disparaging remarks yesterday during a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee.
The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue. We interviewed the president and asked him about his recorded statement quote, "I just found all the classified stuff downstairs," end quote. He told us that he didn't remember saying that to his ghostwriter. He also said he didn't remember finding any classified material in his home after his vice presidency. And he didn't remember anything about how classified documents about Afghanistan made their way into his garage. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do.
Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, had a heated back and forth with the former special counsel, her, yesterday over this report on Biden's handling of classified documents, accusing him of making a political choice that sparked a firestorm.
Sir, the regulations required me to write a confidential report explaining my decision to the Attorney General.
Which you knew would be released.
It was up to the Attorney General to determine
you understood
what
it would be released.
The report
did you
would
not?
Be released consistent with DOJ policy.
You understood it would be released. You understood it would be released.
I understood from the Attorney General's public comments that he would make as much of my report public as he could consistent with legal requirements in DOJ.
And you
policy.
Also understand DOJ policy that you are to take care not to prejudice the interests of the subject of an investigation, right?
That is generally one of the interests that DOJ policy requires that prosecutors respect.
And it was your obligation to follow that policy in this report, was it not?
It was also my obligation to write a confidential report for the Attorney General explaining completely
well,
my
what
decision.
What you did write was deeply prejudicial to the interests of the president. You say it wasn't political, and yet you must have understood. You must have understood the impact of your words. You must have understood the impact of your decision to go beyond the specifics of a particular document, to go to the very general, to your own personal, prejudicial, subjective opinion of the president, one you knew would be amplified by his political opponent, one you knew that would influence a political campaign. You had to understand that. And you did it anyway.
Let's get a taste of the Republican fire at Robert Hur yesterday, largely using their turns at the microphone to question why Hur opted not to recommend charges after finding some evidence that Biden willfully retained government materials after his vice presidency. This is Representative Tom McClintock of California and Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona.
You got the fact that he had classified material in his possession and control in multiple settings for multiple years, that he told others he was aware of this, and that he shared that material with others. The mind boggles at what beyond reasonable doubt would actually mean.
He knows he's got classified docs. He's looking at this. He can't read it. He's giving this to somebody he knows has no security clearance. So he says, hey, read this, but be careful. It might be classified. That warning to be careful because it may be classified, that indicates guilty knowledge.
The evidence, if presented at trial alongside potential defense arguments, would not probably result in a conviction at trial.
Well, that's one of the points you make, is that President Biden's likely to be an elderly, sympathetic a figure with a poor memory. But how does that bear on any individual's guilt or innocence?
Okay, some excerpts from yesterday's testimony before Congress. Robert Hur, who investigated Biden's handling of classified documents. Jonathan, start us off here. Was this a hearing mostly about scoring political points, substance? How do you see it?
Entirely about scoring political points. The substance of the memos was almost entirely irrelevant here. And I think the irony of a bunch of Republicans, decrying a president who supposedly willfully held on to classified documents is so thick and rich I could eat it with a spoon. But in any case, it's just once again evidence of how Congress has sort of devolved into political theater. Mm-hmm. One thing that I thought was really interesting here was that there are sort of two competing storylines that the Republicans are trying to push about President Biden. Right? One is that he's this like feeble old man who has dementia and doesn't know what he's doing, which is sort of one take you could take from Hearst's testimony, right? That the clip we just heard about, he's a well-meaning old man. At the same time, they want to paint him as like a mastermind who, controls this incredible crime family. So at one point on the transcript, Hur said to President Biden, quote, you appear to have a photographic understanding and recall of the house, right? So even inside the transcript, her is noting that actually Biden seems very with it. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, the one storyline, like if you advance that Biden is senile, it sort of detracts from the argument that he's a master crime manipulator, right? And if you push that, it detracts from the argument that he's a senile old man. And so it'll be interesting to see how this is reconciled by the GOP apparatus.
Yeah, and interesting you contrast it with Biden's cooperation with former President Trump's attempts to obstruct efforts to retrieve files he was keeping at Mar-a-Lago. Donna, your thoughts here.
Yeah, I want to pick up that point that Jonathan made about, you know, these two perspectives coming out of the Republican camp, that Biden's a senile old man or that he's this diabolical mastermind, right? And those two things actually can't be reconciled. And you saw it last week in the State of the Union address. Biden gave a State of the Union address. It was well received. I think most commentators immediately after it called him feisty, more or less. And so if, you know, your political opponents lower the bar to such an extent and, you know, say you can't string sentences together, and then, in fact, you can, and you can give a policy speech that resonates with at least part of Congress and the American public, that goes against that narrative that you've crafted. And it is continuing to play out even in this hearing. You know, I would invite people to, you know, to do their homework here. In that, judge for yourself. These are documents that are hundreds of pages long, but, you know, read the special prosecutor's report. Read the transcript of the interview that was released right before the hearings yesterday. I've only read parts of those, but they're very conversational. And the parts of them that I was able to look at so far, you know, show Biden basically, you know, having a in some ways jovial conversation with these people who are interviewing him and giving information. And we should note that he's I think he did 2 days of interviews and he did these voluntarily. Trump has not done this. The report itself that Hur issued contrasts the two presidents here in this regard. And you saw that also displayed in the hearings yesterday where the Democrats oftentimes asked Hur questions where they were juxtaposing Trump's behavior with that as well. So it certainly is political theater, but it is politics. And, you know, that is what this is all about. And Congress engages in a lot of that. And so it is up to citizens not to get this information from social media, but to actually read about it and make judgments for themselves about what they think, not what people, you know, what the frame that actors that they support might try to put this into.
Both of you have mentioned the State of the Union address last Thursday here, just after our Politics Wednesday last week. So just a couple of reflections on that. I mean, for myself, after digesting, as we all do, a lot of the media that focused on Biden's age and memory, I was pretty amazed at well, you said feisty, Donna. Fiery is other words that I read out there, too, that he kept up this pace and was ready for seemingly anything to come out of the Republican ranks in the House. Jonathan, were you also a bit surprised?
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly more forceful than I had anticipated. You know, I would say that, you know, Biden's big secret is that he's actually quite a good retail politician. Like, he seems to really enjoy it. He likes glad handling, you know, politicians and constituents. And as we saw after the State of the Union, you know, you hung around until they turned the lights off. And so that is, you know, I think an underestimated kind of talent of Biden, that he's actually very good at this. He may be the best president at this, you know, since Bill Clinton, like at the retail glad handling side of things. And so, you know, I think, to the extent that he can go out there and do that, it really undercuts the message that, of this, like, you know, senility that the GOP is trying to push. So, you know, I don't know. I imagine he'll be doing more of that going forward.
Yeah.
The reaction was quite positive.
Right. And he knew from last year's State of the Union that he was going to take fire from the chamber, from Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance. And Donna, he seemed to savor those moments and be ready for them.
He does. And if you looked at, I mean, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that this is how Biden is, because this is how Biden has always been. He did a similar thing in last year's State of the Union address, right? He turns the, okay, so we're not going to cut Social Security and Medicare onto the Republicans during that speech, if you recall. You know, acting on your feet, reacting to the moment situation. And he did some of that in this particular speech as well. And, you know, in interacting with people going up and down the aisles, he even interacted with Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, and he doesn't shy away from those things. And we shouldn't be surprised at who Biden is, because that's who Biden has always been.
He's been in politics for a few years, you're saying, Donna.
He's been in politics since the early 70s, right? He's been in the Senate since the early 70s, or he was in the Senate since the early 70s. And so, you know, he and I do think Jonathan is right. He really feeds off of that kind of interaction that, you know, Obama didn't particularly like interacting, I think, mm-hmm. doing the glad-handing thing.
Yeah.
Biden clearly does. And it is a political skill that not everybody has, and it can be very valuable, especially in this kind of environment.
Let's take another break, Jonathan and Donna. And when we come back, let's talk about that leadership shakeup among Senate Republicans. I remember not too long ago, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell set to step down. He says he's stepping down from his position later this year. Now, of course, there's a jostling for position as that leadership is reconfigured. Iowa's Senator Joni Ernst will evidently run to take on the number three position in the Republican Senate leadership for the next Congress, her office confirmed. So I would like to ask our guests for the lay of the land. How does that leadership within the Republican Party in the Senate work? And how is Senator Ernst moving up? We'll be back in a moment.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a Politics Wednesday edition of our program with Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. We're going to talk about Israel and the situation there, how it poses the problem for President Biden, this protest movement over the handling of the Israel-Hamas war spreading to several states. We'll hear some of Biden speaking about that in just a moment in a weekend interview. But let's talk first about that leadership shakeup going on among Senate Republicans. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell set to step down from that position later this year. Our U.S. Senator Joni Ernst will run to take on the number three position in the Republican Senate leadership for the next Congress confirmed by her office. She'll run against U.S. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, previously announced he would seek the post. Donna, give us a sense of how you see Senator Ernst's rise among Republicans and what this step means in the significance of that rise.
So Joni Ernst has long been kind of tapped as a rising star in the Republican Party. Very early on in her term in 2015, I believe it was, she was pegged to give the State of the Union response to one of Obama's State of the Union addresses. And despite all the problems in giving that speech, as we witnessed last week, it is typically someone who is tapped, seen as an up-and-coming person in the party, whoever the opposition party is. And so she's been kind of in the forefront of someone who's seen as having a lot of potential. And she's, you know, just in her second term, is the fourth ranking Republican, being the chair of the Republican Policy Committee. So she wants to seek that third position, being the chair of the Republican conference. And I think, you know, the only other declared candidate is Tom Cotton. I think she probably holds, my guess is, an advantage over Cotton. But we shall see how that plays out, because this will play out behind the scenes in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Would you say, though, a more moderate Republican than Senator Cotton?
I think she's she's more in the forefront. Mm. She has been more active, I think, in doing the things one needs to do to move up in the leadership. And Cotton has been a little bit more individualistic. I think maybe Joni Ernst has seen more as a team player in that regard. And so she also has military experience. And also the Republicans are frequently criticized, especially in the Senate, for being old white men, and she is not one of those. Yeah. And so I think that gives her an advantage in this sense as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, those of us political junkies will pay attention. And almost every time Mitch McConnell spoke, Behind him were the other leading Republicans. Joni Ernst was inevitably there. She was there when Mitch McConnell froze up one time and helped him there. Jonathan, your view on Senator Ernst's rise here in the Republican Senate?
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree with what Donna said. We don't know what the inside, negotiations are going to look like, but my guess is that she's got a leg up over this on Tom Cotton. Cotton, courted some controversy a few years ago when he wrote a New York Times op-ed suggesting that the U.S. military commit war crimes on peacefully protesting American citizens, and that got him a lot of flack. And, Donna's right. He's just seen as a bit more of a maverick. She's a team player. And the optics of having a woman in the top three of the leadership can't hurt.
Yeah. Donna, is this a path that may someday make Ernst leader of Senate Republicans, be they in the minority or the majority in the Senate?
I mean, certainly she's on that trajectory, but lots of things can happen in these kinds of fights. You know, we haven't mentioned who's vying for the central position, the leader position, and that's John Thune and John Cornyn. And neither of them are spring chickens either. And so the leadership, dynamics can change, and it cannot, and sometimes it's not real evident from the outside what those dynamics are. Mm. So certainly I think she has that ambition to stay in the Senate and to stay in the Senate. And then if she were to be elected to the number three position, odds would be favorable that, she would continue to move up in that.
Okay. Let's go to perhaps both of the foreign policy challenges that stand out to the United States right now. The protest movement over President Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war, now spreading to several states, raising questions about whether a small, but we have to say, don't we, I think, a significant number of Democrats are angry at Biden. And their threats, they might abandon him in November. Let's listen to a little bit of President Biden. This is during an exclusive interview with Jonathan Capehart on MSNBC Saturday. President Biden rebuked Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the rising civilian death toll in Gaza, even as he reaffirmed American support for Israel.
He has a right to defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world, it's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake. So I want to see a ceasefire. And I'm starting with a major, major exchange of prisoners. For a six-week period, we're going into Ramadan. It should be nothing happening, and we should build off of that ceasefire. And look, I've spoken with the majority of the Arab leaders from Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Jordan. They're all prepared to fully recognize Israel and begin to rebuild the region. And that's the focus. What comes after Gaza? What's next? It's a tough decision, but there's a lot that can be done.
In that same MSNBC interview on Saturday, Biden was asked by Jonathan Capehart whether an Israeli military operation in Rafah was a red line for the administration. He answered yes. A day later, Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, pushed back in an interview with Politico.
You know, I have a red line. You know what the red line is? That October 7th doesn't happen again. Never happens again. And to do that, we have to complete the destruction of the Hamas terrorist army. We're very close to victory. It's close at hand. We've destroyed three-quarters of Hamas fighting terrorist battalions, and we're close to finishing the last part in Rafah, and we're not going to give it up. Once we begin the intense action of eradicating the Hamas terrorist battalions in Rafah, it's a matter of weeks and not months. That means it's not going to take more than 2 months, maybe 6 weeks, maybe four.
Jonathan Haseed, how do you see the tension between the U.S. president and the Israeli prime minister at this point?
Yeah, it's clearly growing. The U.S. intelligence community released an assessment this week, I think, saying that Netanyahu was likely to be under tremendous domestic pressure, that he was that there's likely going to be a movement in Israel to have him removed from office. And so it seems to me I mean, that's, I think that's right. Netanyahu is extremely unpopular. You know, he wants to keep the war going so that he can remain in power. And so I think the Biden administration is smart to highlight the difference between support for Israel and support for Benjamin Netanyahu in trying to really walk along this tightrope between, you know, supporting Israel enough so that, you know, Democratic-leaning American Jews and Israel supporters in other parts of the country are satisfied with Biden. And of course, not upsetting, you know, the Arab American community, which has historically been pretty, also pretty democratic leaning, and of course is concentrated in, you know, swing states like Michigan. And so it seems to me that that Biden has a kind of a twofold approach. The one is to try to slowly, and I think there are elements of the administration moving toward this, split Netanyahu from Israel, right? We can so condemning the one without condemning the other. Mm-hmm. And the second strategy seems to me, to just sort of, you know, have symbolic, mostly symbolic gestures that sort of appeal to both sides. And what amounts to a little bit of a kind of a weird, silly thing where we're funding both sides of the conflict. So, you know, the U.S. will give bombs to Israel, which will then get dropped on Gaza, and then, you know, turn around and drop parachutes of food on Gaza. And so it's a bit incoherent, I think, but... probably the way that the administration has figured out that they're going to try to, you know, stay on this tightrope as long as they can.
Mm-hmm. Donna, do you see it the same way?
Yeah, tightrope is, you know, kind of a good word to use there, I think, as well, because this is, you know, notoriously been a difficult part of the globe for decades and decades. And we could even go back centuries at one level, too. But there's no love loss, I don't think, between Biden and Bibi Netanyahu. At the moment. And Netanyahu has played that in years past, appearing before Congress, for example. As a matter of fact, just before we went on the air, I saw that Netanyahu is actually speaking via video link to the Senate GOP retreat that they're having. Mm. And so Netanyahu's not above playing internal domestic politics in the United States as well. And certainly Jonathan's right. I think the challenges that he has, that Netanyahu has domestically within Israel, are tremendous, and they're only going to grow, I think, too. And world pressure is going to also put pressure on him as well.
Yeah. Donna, how concerned should the Biden campaign be about these Democratic voters? We saw it most pronounced in Michigan in that primary, abandoning him in November. Do we go back to the same, we're a long ways from the general election phrase?
Well, yes and no. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I think Biden has been aware of that. He's been somewhat responsive to it. But, you know, at the end of the day, Rashida Tlaib, who's in Congress, was one of she's the only Palestinian American in Congress, and is from Michigan, was instrumental in that, you know, getting people to vote for uncommitted mm-hmm. in the Michigan primary. But, you know, she doesn't want Trump to be president. That's not going to be better in this situation. And so, again, I go back to something I think I said earlier. It's, you know, you have to deal with the possible, not the perfect. It is appropriate for people within a coalition to bring their issues to the fore and to put pressure on leaders. But then when we get to November, those entities have to make nice. And Biden is good at bringing a coalition together and getting to the next step, I think, as well. And so it is something he has to pay a lot of attention to. It's a different challenge, though, than Trump has in terms of trying to, you know, corral never Trumpers to vote for him, because that's just not going to happen. But mm-hmm. Biden has work to do, definitely. But I think he's probably up to that task.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, I don't know how much you've looked in, you know, the opposition what is happening in Israel by the Democratic Party, the specific demographics here. There seems to be younger Democrats, a generational divide there in their opinions over Gaza. Have you looked into that? How do you explain that?
I've looked at it a bit. Yeah, it's basically, you know, older Democrats. So American Democrats on the whole are quite a left-leaning group. Now, of course, there are conservative Jews in America, but this is mostly a group that votes for Democrats. And has done for decades. And so the divide is not so much there, although it does seem like Biden may be losing support among sort of younger American Jews. You know, the numbers here aren't great. It's a small subsample. It's hard to poll. So we can say that the generational divide really does seem to be between the sort of views of Israel in particular. So, you know, older American Jews have a very, very supportive view of Israel. You know, they see it as a key American ally, and younger American Jews are on the whole much less persuaded by, you know, the idea that Israel represents Jews all over the world.
But not just among American Jews, but among the younger generation of Americans at large, right?
That's right. Yes, that's right. That Israel has lost considerable support on the left and the right. Yes, in recent years among young people, I think that's sort of indisputably true by you know, a number of studies. So yeah, in that sense, you know, some of it or some of the reason is or the factors that Donna pointed to is that, you know, Netanyahu has played extensive politics with you know, the United States. So for example, he refused a visit deliver an address to Congress in front of Obama, but then when he was invited by Republicans, he was willing to do that. So that kind of, like, you know, when he put his thumb on the scale and made it very clear that he was supporting Republicans over Democrats, that's going to have downstream effect. And he's been doing this for years. Netanyahu's been making very clear his views for 15 or 20 years. And when you put your thumb on the scale, in a polarized climate that we have, that's going to pull some support away from Israel. Mm-hmm. It's just inevitable. So in that sense, yeah, you know, Israel is losing a generation of young people because of, you know, people like Netanyahu. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. Yesterday, the Biden administration said it will send an additional $300 million in security assistance to Ukraine, calling it an extraordinary measure as the president's request for billions of dollars more remains stalled in Congress. An emergency package announced by the White House funded by, quote, unanticipated cost savings from contracts with the Pentagon had brokered to replace weapons previously provided to Ukraine. I reference this also because Ukraine, I think you'll agree, unusually, Donna, was the very first thing Biden talked about in his State of the Union last week. That's unusual to lead with foreign policy, isn't it?
It is in this era. It's not unheard of. But again, in that speech, nothing is where it is on accident. So the fact that he began with that is quite notable, and also was, you know, to put pressure on Congress to advertise to both the American public, but also the world, you know, the U.S.'s position, official position on that. And, you know, we have a lot of chaos going on in Congress currently surrounding that supplemental that would fund Israel, aid to Israel, aid to Taiwan, aid to Ukraine. And it passed the Senate earlier by a, you know, huge vote, 70 in the Senate. The problem in the House is the Speaker of the House will not bring that bill up. If he were to bring that bill up, it would pass. Mm. Virtually everyone agrees. But he is not bringing that bill up, which is his prerogative in the majoritarian House. There are two ways around that, and only one typically is used, and that is what they are resorting to in the House currently. So we've seen this week movement on two discharge petitions. The fact that there are two discharge petitions, which would discharge that bill and get it to the floor, is actually problematic. There should really ideally only be one if you actually want to move that bill. One is has 169 signatures on it. You have to get 218, a majority, to get that to the floor. And they may be able to get that. It remains to be seen. That bill that has the largest block of support would discharge that Senate bill so that they could vote on it. The other one, the competing one, is the more problematic one from a perspective of getting something done. It's done by the Problem Solvers Caucus. There's only about, I think, 12 signatories to that last I checked, but they're Democrats and Republicans. And it is not the Senate bill, which means that if the House were to pass something, it would have to go back to the Senate, and then that becomes more problematic. So in terms of if you are a supporter of that supplemental, you want the House to be able to pass that Senate bill. And they're working on it, but it's still a bit of a long slog.
What a complicated picture. You have your handle on it, Donna. Thank you for giving us the insights. We appreciate your analysis. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Chuck and Barbara Grassley, Professor of Political Science there. Jonathan Hasid, thanks to you for your insights as well and analysis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, Donna, until next time, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, we'll discuss how the buildup of nitrate in farm fields that has likely been a result of the drought has set the stage for a potentially massive uptick in stream pollution. My guest for part of the program tomorrow, Iowa water quality expert Chris Jones, tomorrow on the program. Today's River to River, produced by Caitlin Troutman, with help from Phil Moss and Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.